Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books Network in Medieval History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. I'm Evan Zarkadas, your host, and today I have the great pleasure of talking with two incredible scholars and the editors of the recent book, The Invention of Byzantium in Early Modern Europe, published in 2021 by Dumbarton Oaks Press. Dr. Nathaniel Ashenbrennan is a late medieval and early modern historian who works on the intersection of ideas and power in the Mediterranean world, and is also the lecturer at the University of California, San Diego in the Department of History. And Jake Ransohoff, Hellenism's past and present postdoctoral fellow at Stavros Niarchos Foundation at Simon Fraser University. Hello, Nate and Jake. I was extremely happy to hear that you both are fans of the New Books Network, so I am honored to welcome you to the show.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having us. We're really excited to be here.
Yeah, it's terrific to be here, Evan. Thank you.
Perfect. And you're calling us all the way. I'm on the East Coast, and you're Nate is in California right now, and Jake is calling us from Vancouver, Canada. So. Different time zones, but thank you for being here. I'd like to start our conversation with both of you telling us a little bit about yourselves first.
Sure. I'm happy to go first. So as you mentioned, Evan, I'm a postdoctoral fellow here at the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Center in Simon Fraser University, Burnaby in British Columbia. I defended my PhD at Harvard in June 2022, so just recently. And, I grew up in Florida, actually, so it was very far away from either Harvard or here where I am right now in BC. I've always had a deep interest in history. I think it was a way of rebelling against my surroundings. You know, Florida sometimes presents itself as a place without any history. In my rebellious phase, the more arcane and obscure the history, the better. It doesn't really get more arcane than Byzantium. So I went into undergraduate work at the University of Chicago, already really interested in Byzantine studies, and I was kind of encouraged and guided on that direction by my undergraduate mentor, the late Walter Keiki. And so I've ended up on this path.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. My path to Byzantine history is a bit more circuitous than Jake's, I might say. I grew up in Alaska. And I was an undergraduate at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, and I served as an officer in the Navy, doing a bunch of different jobs. I got out in 2009, and I was interested in medieval history. It's a transition. It's a well-trodden path from being a naval officer to a medieval historian. I studied some classical languages, and I did a master's degree at Georgetown and in King's College London, and then I did my PhD at Harvard, and I finished in 2019, and that's where Jake and I first met each other.
Interesting. So you guys both met at Harvard.
That's right.
Perfect. Yeah. And your positions are recent. So congratulations on those. I think for both ends, for what you're doing right now. I'm sure it's quite exciting.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
And it's I love hearing how people come to the path of Byzantium. It's so many diverse paths that lead people to Byzantium.
Yeah, no one gets there by a straight line.
Right. So thank you. Let's dive right in. I first saw the invention of Byzantium in early modern Europe being advertised by Dumperton Oaks when I was working on my master's thesis in Byzantium. And I kind of wish it was published earlier because I saw some of the articles there and I'm like, oh, I wish I had those in my citation. But it was published after that. But either way, tell me a little bit about what the book is about. Where did this idea start from? You know, the invention of Byzantium.
Yeah, well, I'll jump in here. You know, the book is about how and why scholars in early modern Western Europe, for the purposes of this volume, it's defined roughly 1450 to 1850, but you know, it's a flexible category as far as the volume is concerned. But how and why scholars studied the texts and the artifacts and the history that we now describe as Byzantine. And you know, as Nate mentioned, we met in graduate school. We both had the same advisor. Nate was a year ahead of me. And we discovered during my first year there at Harvard that we had this shared interest. Nate and I both had this deep shared interest in, especially in the figure of Charles Ducange, a French scholar who lived from 1610 to 1688 and is renowned for being a really phenomenally productive scholar in a number of different fields, but including Byzantine studies. You know, he published this lexicography of medieval Greek that's still used, works on Constantinople and its monuments, works on Byzantine genealogy. So both Nate and I had a real interest in this figure and an interest in the history of scholarship. And we were disappointed by the lack of work on this figure of Ducange. And so we thought, well, you know, maybe let's organize a conference about this figure, about Ducange and his contribution to Byzantine studies. And as we started along that path, and very quickly we discovered that in order to make sense of Ducange, one really had to reframe some of our basic assumptions about the study of Byzantium as a whole and its place in early modern intellectual history. So we did end up going through with this conference, but the conference was about sort of the invention of Byzantium in early modern Europe as a category. And that conference was in 2017. We were really pleased with the quality of the papers. We felt like there were important insights, great discussions that were generated. And so we were really lucky that the project got picked up by Dumperton Oaks, and we were able to kind of continue working on a book that was based on the conference. And it's now come out with DO Press in 2021.
Yeah, I would just I would add to that that one of the things when we were making that transition from sort of thinking about Ducange as a figure and then sort of thinking about his intellectual context, I think that we together, as we sort of read our way through the relevant literature on the origins of Byzantine scholarship, the development of Byzantine studies in early modern Europe, we realized there was room for a different and a much bigger project, a project that would constitute a sort of fundamental historiographical realignment of the field. And I think that is part of the way sort of we move from talking about an individual scholar, even one as titanically important as Ducange, to a book that's trying to kind of sketch a new provisional history of Byzantine scholarship.
Right. And I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think so you mentioned that the conference took place in 2017. And from what I was aware, there was, I believe, this conversation within the field of, from scholars like Anthony Kaldelis and such, of, trying to find the origins of Byzantium. Do you think that, because I see your book kind of like the culmination of all of these conversations that happen in, let's say, the past five, maybe more years. Where do you see that book in correlation with those scholarly conversations within the field?
Yeah, that's a great question, Evan. I think the first thing that that Jake and I would say is that we see the book not so much as a culmination, but rather a sort of a new beginning, we hope, for a, you know, a study of the history of Byzantine scholarship in the early modern world. We've got a lot of great articles in the book, but we would not we wouldn't dare to claim that we've sort of said the last word on it. If anything, what we're trying to do is kind of set up a framework and set out kind of a collection of methods that will allow people to make more progress on this. But I do think that you're right that there's a degree to which we wanted to build off a renewed interest in historicizing some of the categories that we take for granted in the fields of Byzantine studies. And one of the categories that I'm sure we're going to talk about a lot today is the very word and concept of Byzantium, but also, identity. How did Byzantines think about themselves? How did early modern scholars struggle to categorize the culture and the products of the world that we now call Byzantine? So those are, I think, some of the ways that we saw our project relating to the existing discussions on the origins of Byzantium, the origins of Byzantine scholarship.
I was just going to say, I think that's exactly right, Nate. That was very well said. It is interesting, Evan, now that you bring this up, I'm thinking about the ways that there is something of a, as you point out, a real discussion that's taking place, not just in Byzantine studies, but I think across different fields of medieval studies, where there's an interrogation or a willingness to interrogate some of these older conceptual frameworks in which these studies have been pursued. Anglo-Saxon scholarship right now is in a major debate over whether or not to retain that term. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a way to see a conversation about both the term Byzantium and the parameters of the study as being part of this much wider movement that's taking place throughout kind of medieval scholarship. And so there's a way that both Nate and I feel that a deep conviction, a commitment to continuing in this tradition of trying to rethink critically what it means to work on Byzantine material, what it means when we talk about the Byzantines, but also a deep-seated conviction that we can't really envision the field or reimagine the future of the field without really understanding the past and understanding everything that has gone into bringing us where we are right now in terms of both the terms that we use to discuss the field and the kind of conceptual furniture that we all carry around in our heads that helps structure our conceptions of what goes in and what goes out of Byzantine studies.
Right. Yeah. And after reading your book, I thought I knew, Byzantine studies, we all know where that came from. But after reading your book, I should say I was a little speechless on, how complicated really this whole subject is.
Yeah, thanks. That's very gratifying to hear, Evan. And I think, I think that that's one of the broad arguments that we wanted to make in this book is that, previous narratives about the history of Byzantine scholarship in the early modern world, whether those are narratives about sort of enduring Western disdain, or we're constantly sort of flagellating ourselves with these incredibly eloquent quotes from Edward Gibbon. The history of Byzantine scholarship, I think we're trying to show, is actually much more complex, much richer, much more discordant than those reductive narratives have suggested. And in fact, basically in every age, you've got you've got cheerleaders, you've got detractors, and a range of figures in between.
Right. Yeah. And you do see, that the detraction, as you say, and sometimes even today, I want to say I've seen it in things that we read and how we engage with the field, or how the field is placed in today's scholarly world. But let's move on to the words, and you mentioned the word Byzantium and Byzantine. I know even today there is a debate with scholars. Do we keep the word? Do we not keep the word? What does it mean? Where did it come from? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I think that really goes to kind of the heart of the book. You know, it's our contention, obviously, that Byzantium as a cultural category is constructed. It's not natural. It is made up out of the scholarly and polemical efforts of people in the early modern world, but it stands on kind of a foundation of medieval conceptions about what was going on in the Byzantine Empire. I think that the important thing to recognize about the Middle Ages is that you've got a kind of a tension between the various ways people are speaking about themselves and categorizing others in the Middle Ages. The Byzantines called themselves Romans, thought of themselves as Romans. They saw their state as a continuation of the Roman Empire of antiquity. And in the medieval West, it was very different. You know, increasingly after the 9th and 10th century, there was a real competition over the legacy of the ancient Roman Empire, and a number of states in the West were interested in appropriating the legitimacy that came with being able to say, that they were the authentic heirs to the Roman tradition. So while in the Middle Ages you have a kind of we're Romans, no, you're Greeks dynamic going on, things get more complicated beginning in the 15th and 16th century as scholars in the West are more inclined to take those claims to Roman identity seriously, and then thinking about where that leaves Byzantium compared to these categories that they're familiar with, whether it's Roman antiquity, Greek antiquity.
Yeah, that's very well said, Nate. And just to build on that, you know, if kind of jumping ahead or fast forwarding to the moment that's often seen as the origins of modern Byzantine studies as a field, the 19th century, as Nate brought up very well, there is just a constant set of discordant voices in the long history of Byzantium, both through the Middle Ages and then even into early modernity, about who or what is a Byzantine. You know, they're both Roman and Greek, they're Western and Eastern. There are all of these different kind of sliding, fluid types of categories. And once you kind of have the development of the field Byzantine studies, and you have these well-defined lines, you know, ends up getting put into a box and, okay, but Byzantium starts in 330 when Constantine officially inaugurates the city of Constantinople, or it starts in 610 with the rise of Heraclius, or it starts with the Islamic conquest. Wherever you want to draw the line, there is this understanding that there are certain very hard boundaries and that there is something called Byzantium. And so that, in some ways, that almost sets up this mirage, because if you have people from the 19th century onward looking back to the history of scholarship and trying to articulate a genealogy for their field, if you're looking for the types of categories that exist post-19th century, this very hard and fast category of Byzantium, of course, you don't find anything. Right? It's very much a product of this historical moment that we're still living with the legacy of. So in some ways, and this was one of the key insights that this project was founded upon and that we hope comes across in the book, is that these hegemonic narratives of absence or disdain that often dominate the kind of themes in which the history of the field is articulated. Part of this is a product of what scholars have tended to look for in studying the history of Byzantine scholarship rather than what exists there to be found. And when we actually change some of our parameters and think in more flexible ways, we find that Byzantine material moves from the margins or moves from this neglected kind of afterthought, this tale of Greek or Roman civilization, to the very center of questions that are really vitally important to scholars throughout the Middle Ages and into early modernity.
Right, right. And I do, and it's also, I think, worth seeing, and through your book and, getting into the a little bit of the weeds of finding all this history of how the field came to be and the name and such, how closely connected the field, but also the process of figuring out what Byzantium is or what isn't, how closely connected it is with so many political events throughout Europe. I thought that was super, super interesting.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's right. It was interesting to us too, as we kind of sat down and started to think about some of this material and engaged in conversations with all of the contributors to the volume. One of the major takeaways for us is that Byzantine studies is this unrelentingly political endeavor. And in part because the category of Byzantine material objects, texts that we would now call Byzantine, are susceptible to all of these different types of interpretations, whether you want to classify them as Greek or Roman, as Western or Eastern, as medieval or ancient, wherever an individual falls on that spectrum in terms of defining a Byzantine text says a lot about their own agendas and preconceptions and what they want to get across, right? So it serves as this really interesting kind of mirror that reflects back on some of the unspoken or spoken assumptions that go into the work of different scholars across time.
Right. And when it comes to the term, Byzantium, in the beginning, I was listening to all of this, certain scholars that will make the argument, we need to abandon the term and, use what they used to do, Eastern Romans or Eastern Roman Empire, right? Continue that and change it. And, after reading the book and after doing and looking how rich it is, I felt that, the term is so heavy right now. That I think if you take it away, it's just so much lost. So using Byzantium because of this history of how the term came to be, good or bad. It's a certain history, and I think it tells a lot about preconceptions in Europe, but also in Greece and throughout the world of the scholarly world, of course, of how they were engaged with this particular region.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's right. It's, this is a trenchant critique in the field right now about whether we should continue to conceptualize the Eastern Roman Empire centered in Constantinople as Byzantine, or whether we should abandon that in favor of just acknowledging what they called themselves, which was Romans. I think that there's a lot of analytical value to asking those questions, and I think one of the products of that vein of scholarship has been, a more rigorous interrogation of how Byzantines expressed and articulated and conceptualized their identity. But at the same time, I think it's still premature to throw over this category as the category of Byzantine or Byzantium as problematic as it may be, as constructed as it may be. I think that we can acknowledge that that Byzantium represents a kind of a confection of Roman political traditions, Greek cultural and literary traditions, and distinctive Christian identity in a way that's distinctive from ancient Rome or even late ancient Roman Empire. And even more than that, I think that when you're a scholar, the answer is always more scholarship. And I think that we're just at the beginning of this process of really writing a new history of the concept and the terminology of Byzantium and Byzantine. And we have a lot more work to do. I'll just give you one very brief example. The word Byzantium, which of course gets used in the 16th century, and scholars in the past I think have said, oh yes, Byzantium is an invention of the 16th century. Well, that's a problematic view for a bunch of reasons that are explored in the book. There are several people who talk about kind of that myth of creation in the 16th century with scholars like Hieronymus Bolth. But the word Byzantium, of course, has a long and distinguished medieval pedigree, certainly in Latin, And it's a kind of word, yes, it's an archaism for the city of Constantinople, but it has a kind of long medieval, terminological history that we haven't really even begun to sort of explore or unpack. And so, there's still so much about this, emerging coherence of this term and this word that remains to be studied and remains to really be explored. And so I think, we'd be premature throwing it over when we don't have a really rich sense of its origin and development yet.
And I think that's what makes it exciting, this mystery sometimes and the gates that it opens when you open a gate and there's even more that open up afterwards. But I think I did read on the book that this particular book is the, let's say, like the official first attempt into looking at the Byzantine studies. Did I put that right?
Well, I think what we're trying to do with the book, I would hesitate to say it's the official first attempt to do anything. I think it's much more humble than that. But we did want this volume to be more than just the proceedings of a conference, more than just a collection of sort of vaguely related chapters on a theme. We really wanted to try to bring it together, and as far as we were able, create a sort of new synthetic vision of Byzantine studies, if only to have other scholars respond to it and criticize it, and to impel future work. So in that sense, if we can kind of create an alternative narrative about the development of Byzantine studies that allows others to engage with it in a kind of fruitful way and build on it, depart from it, but at least have some sort of significance for directing the field going forward to think about some of the issues that are core to the volume, then I think we would be very pleased, and we would have thought that it's served its purpose.
Right, open more conversations and more opportunities for further research. Right,
yeah,
and
exactly.
That's all
right.
You can hope. Perfect. If you have anything else to add on that particular component, I think our audience would like to kind of go not too much into detail, but kind of briefly expand on these four stages that you have structured the book on, the history of Byzantine studies from 1450 to the 1900s, and that are clearly introduced in the book, with the first one, the humanist indifference. Who can give a shot, a quick summary, I guess, of that particular look into the beginnings of Byzantine studies?
I'll say that the four stages, this is our attempt to really summarize the kind of paradigmatic understanding of Byzantine scholarship up to this point. So there are these very famous works in the field, certain articles or different introductions to chapters. George Ostrogorsky or Alexander Vasiliev have prefaced their different and very influential histories of Byzantine studies with this sort of survey of Byzantine scholarship. And those surveys tend to fall into what we characterize as these sort of four stages approach, where every different kind of stage, we have humanism and the kind of Baroque era and the Enlightenment, the 19th century, all these different stages are characterized by certain kind of hegemonic attitudes towards Byzantium. So this is actually what we're really trying to get away from. But this is what we see as being kind of holding the field right now, or still the kind of armature that people carry around with them. So to answer that question, in terms of the humanist indifference, which is often represented as this kind of first stage of Byzantine scholarship, when you look at histories of Byzantine studies up to now, they will often represent the engagement of scholars in the 15th century and the early 16th century with Byzantine materials as this kind of indifferent engagement with the material. So people, individuals like Poliziano or in Florence, or Leonardo Bruni, I mean, there are a number of really famous humanists, even Erasmus, are using Byzantine manuscripts. They're sometimes learning Greek from Byzantine refugees, but they're not really interested in Byzantium itself. They think about these materials, these individuals, as being portals, which they can get back to ancient Greece. So they're really interested in Plato and in the Academy, or they're interested in early Christianity, right? And so they're sort of instrumentally using the Byzantines as Byzantine material as this way of accessing that earlier history, but they're not really interested in the Byzantine material itself. Right? This, again, is the kind of caricature vision of what the humanists are doing that's often put forward in histories of Byzantine scholarship.
Right, and I think Gibbon, is Gibbon in this particular category as well, or is he a little later on?
Gibbon's a little bit later. Yeah, he's often considered to be an Enlightenment figure. So really, you know, part of this 18th century milieu that involves people like Montesquieu and Voltaire.
Right. Right, and from your book, I think I picked this. I picked this part out about the philosophers such as Montesquieu and Voltaire, and how they described it as a history of nothing but rebellion, seditions, and treachery. yeah. So you kind of like, I guess, with that line, you kind of see how the field or you know the study of was influenced, I guess, or was seen as.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges for Byzantine studies, I mean, Gibbon has been has exercised an enormous influence on our field, both by popularizing the history of the Byzantine Empire to a certain extent, and by saying unbelievably witty, cutting things about the Byzantine Empire that tend to stick in people's heads. I think there's a certain similarity in sort of intellectual milieu, a certain similarity in philosophical disposition among figures like Gibbon, Montesquieu, and Voltaire. And we often get the kind of regurgitation of their criticisms of the Byzantine world when it when people talk about kind of Byzantium in the Enlightenment, and those criticisms are fair, but I think what we're trying to show for each of these four stages is that actually within those stages it is. It misleads us to assume that there's a kind of a single, as Jake put it, a single sort of hegemonic attitude towards the Byzantine world. And in fact, there are a number of people who are, looking at Byzantium in different ways, pulling it apart in interesting ways, rejecting, one piece of it, maybe rejecting the theology of the Byzantine Church and embracing the model of Byzantine monarchy, or I think this is one of the fascinating things that we try to show in the book is that, the people who are engaging with the Byzantine world, they're able to sort of atomize it and find the pieces of it that they find admirable or they find, worthy of critique.
You're exactly right, Nate. It makes me think of this kind of famous example of a figure like Edward Gibbon, who in his History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, will call the Byzantines Greek whenever they lose a battle, but they're Romans when they win a battle. Right? There's this way of kind of disambiguating this identity, which seems unified to us, but the complexion of Byzantine history takes on a very different color depending upon the context in which it's being engaged with. Right? I think that gets straight to Nate's point of the ability of some of these scholars to kind of atomize. And even figures who have given some of these, Montesquieu or Gibbon, these really damning kind of cutting one-liner characterizations or this dripping with contempt. It's pretty fascinating that when you even look beyond that, Byzantium does sit at the center of Montesquieu's historical vision. Gibbon is spending an enormous amount of time studying Byzantine history, and he really puts it at the core of his kind of global or multi-regional account of the medieval world, all of which is sort of revolving around Constantinople. So if we sort of move beyond the kind of one-liners and the rhetoric and actually are looking at the role that Byzantium is playing, even in this kind of philosophic vision of history, often it is very much at the center and at the heart of the kinds of historical lessons that these erudites, or these philosophers rather, these philosophical historians are trying to illustrate.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, like a great example of this, an example of the kind of space between these, these 18th century writers who are writing histories of the Byzantine world and the late Middle Ages, for instance, is exactly what Jake said. I mean, in spite of the fact that, Montesquieu and Gibbon both have really damning things to say about sort of the inherent virtue of the Byzantines, they nonetheless accept the fact that this is part of the long history of the Roman Empire. And that's a framework that would have been largely inconceivable to Latin historians of the Middle Ages. So you see right there a way in which, if we can move beyond, as Jake said, move beyond the one-liners, we can see that there's something really quite innovative that has already occurred by the 18th century in the way that scholars were trying to conceptualize and sort of place the Byzantine world among these familiar categories.
Yes, that is so interesting to think because, as you mentioned, behind the behind the scenes thing is so much more detailed, but whatever sticks in the populace or whatever sticks is those one liners, and then they keep going. But everything else gets forgotten, and it's like, where did that come from? So that's the first stage, I guess, the humanist indifference, and then you mentioned stage number two, the Baroque enthusiasm, and what happens there?
Yeah, so the Baroque enthusiasm, I think this is, the period of the 17th century. It's often associated with France and the French court. You get a new series of Byzantine publications associated with the Byzantine du Louvre. This is a French series sponsored by the Bourbon monarch Louis XIV. And the aim is to edit and publish a huge range of authors from the Byzantine world. And in traditional histories of Byzantine scholarship, this is like a new moment of appreciation for the Byzantine world, particularly for the literature broadly conceived of Byzantium, and it's certainly true, and it's a fascinating cultural moment. It's a cultural period that really culminates in the figure of Ducange, who was an incredible scholar, an incredible figure in many fields, not just Byzantine studies, and who was very quickly recognized by his peers as somebody who had would really sort of gone beyond the efforts of his predecessors. But there's, again, it's a much richer period in the 17th century. You also have, you've got, the continuation of all kinds of counter-reformation political and polemical projects. A figure that I've looked at in another publication, Jakob Gretzer, who's a Jesuit in the early 17th century at the Jesuit College in Ingolstadt. He has a very different take. Baroque enthusiasm is not the way I would categorize his interest in the Byzantine world. He's one of these figures who thinks that there's a kind of, an authentic Christian core that can be kind of separated from the surrounding chaff of heretical ecclesiology around the Byzantine church. And so, this another example of how, thinking of this period as dominated by this enthusiasm for the Byzantine world ends up effacing a broad array of divergent engagements with this material.
Right. And then we have the third stage, the Enlightenment contempt. Why contempt?
This is sort of what we were just talking about in terms of Gibbon and Montesquieu, right? The attitudes of some of these Enlightenment thinkers towards Byzantium, which is often interpreted as kind of a reaction against religiosity, a reaction against the perceived absolutism and authoritarianism of the Byzantine world, which because of its association in the Baroque period with absolutist monarchs like Louis XIV, becomes this kind of punching bag for these philosophers to make certain claims about the importance of representative government and free thinking and rationality. And so Byzantium becomes a caricature of the kind of monk-ridden, bastion of authoritarianism that many of these philosophic historians want to move away from. But as we were just saying, right, that's only one facet of their very multifaceted engagement with Byzantium and Byzantine materials.
Right. And then, of course, the last stage, the 19th century institutionalization.
Yeah, and I think this is a familiar stage because I think in a lot of histories of Byzantine studies, this is really the maturation or the consummation of a quest towards a kind of independent discipline. We can think about sort of the first chairs in Byzantine studies that are being set up in German universities. Of course, Karl Krumbacher founds a new journal, Byzantinische Zeitschrift, and writes about what he thinks this project that he's engaged in. He also writes a new history of Byzantine literature, and Anthony Caldelis talks about this in his article in the book. And there are, of course, really important changes in this field. The development of dedicated university programs that are solely focused on investigating the Byzantine world, new seminars, new journals, new publication series, all of those things are really important, and they're sort of aiming towards creating the field as an independent and sort of self-standing discipline. And that's a critical late stage in the development of Byzantine studies, but it's a stage that emerges from the collective labors of several centuries of scholarly endeavor that we explore. And of course, it's one form of the discipline. It's a form that we know. It's a form that to a large extent we inhabit. But it's not the only way to study the history of the Byzantine world or to engage the history of the Byzantine world as we try to show.
Right. How was from your knowledge, how was the introduction and creation of the field received by other fields? Because I know the medieval field, of course, has a long history of established scholarship. How was that in relation to, here we are, a Byzantine new field, or maybe the official stamp, I guess, as a field, because it's always been there.
So thinking back to the 19th century, there was a deep embrace of Byzantine studies as a field that needed to be addressed on its own terms. Someone like Theodore Mommsen, famous Roman historian, was very much a cheerleader for Byzantine studies. At the same time, though, it's that kind of separation of Byzantium from its classical Greek heritage that has helped to sort of give this field a sense of its own marginalization. So for instance, in the 19th century, when you had the first edition of this famous Greek lexicon by, I'm blanking on the name, Nate.
Are we talking Liddell and Scott?
Liddell and Scott, thank you. Yeah, when you had the formation of the Liddell and Scott lexicon, at one point, Krumbacher, the chair of Byzantine history, or Byzantine literature rather, in Munich, was going to be part of the editorial board for this, for future editions, and wanted there to be Byzantine Greek terminology in this lexicon. And it was decided, well, no, that's not really part of this field. You're your own separate thing. You have to make your own lexicon, you know? And so, I mean, it's just until recently that we actually have had with the publication of Eric Trapp's lexicon of Byzantine Greek, the creation of a lexicon that really engages with the Byzantine language at this time. So there was both a desire to see some of this work being done, but also it created structures that separated, sometimes artificially, Byzantium as a language, as a literature, as, you know, a historiographical pursuit from some of these other, you know, fields. And in some ways, and that was almost the point, you know, Anthony Kaldelis, in his article, talks about some of the political, the political motivations behind kind of creating a space in which Byzantium exists and isn't touching some of these other traditions. Like if one was to embrace the Greekness of Byzantium and see it, as many Greek nationalists did, as this sort of bridge between ancient Greece and modern Greece, there's a danger of that playing into certain irredentist Greek claims to territory that would potentially, you know, in the 19th century, upset different balances of power, right? So there was also a real political interest in kind of creating a core on sanitaire around Byzantium and Byzantine history and saying, no, this was its own thing. It was totally separate. And as a result, it has no modern nation to which its material can be repatriated. There's no single person who can claim it. It's its own separate kind of bubble.
Yeah. Just to build on that, I mean, that was a powerful idea, but there's a something of a historical irony at play here that always strikes me when I think about this phase of Byzantine studies in the 19th century, which is, in the 19th century, the independence of your discipline was sort of a mark of sort of professional maturation, right? You've made it as a discipline when you've got your own journals and you've got your own chairs and your own publication series, etc. But I think that it created these artificial distinctions among fields that we have in the last, 20 years come to see is increasingly problematic. The fact that, graduate students in America, for instance, who study the Western Middle Ages, often don't study Greek, and they don't really know much about the Byzantine world. But you could say the same for Byzantinists. I mean, a lot of Byzantinists don't really work with Latin materials and don't necessarily know very much about the medieval West. And so it's been created as a kind of hermetically sealed space that has its own, languages and corpora and instrumenta. But those boundaries are creations of the 19th century, and they're pretty artificial. And as we've, come to... we have come to see our discipline in different ways more recently. I think that those boundaries seem increasingly problematic insofar as they create these frontiers that prevent us from seeing connections across historical connections across these fields.
Right. The more we talk about it, the more I'm like, whew. It's such so many different paths just lead to it. And I think that your title, The Invention of Byzantium, it just brings so much into the conversation. Again, so much more complicated than a simple name or a simple title. Kind of mind-blowing to think just how deep this goes and how far up it's going to reach at some point. Right, so... we're coming close to our time. I really enjoyed this conversation. Again, you need a whole podcast dedicated to this on its own. But I think we're trying to do some justice to your work and the book, of course. A question that I have is, where do you see the study of Byzantium going into in the future?
Yeah. What, so building off of, I think, what Nate and I would like this book to be contributing here is if we think about Byzantium and the way that we understand Byzantium now is not necessarily a kind of natural or inevitable category, but the but one of many permutations that have existed in terms of what counts as Byzantine, what the scope of this field is, something that's constantly changed over the course of time. And so we're living in this kind of historical moment right now where, you know, the legacy of the 19th century still looms large, but it's far from the only way to conceptualize our field. I think if we internalize that notion, you know, it leads us to interrogate some of the basic parameters that we work in today. I think I see that happening across Byzantine studies in a really exciting way. You know, we can see this now in the fact that more Byzantinists are learning Syriac and Arabic in addition to Slavic languages. We can see this in the fact that Byzantinists are interested in thinking about the connections between Byzantine culture and Nubian and Ethiopian cultures in Africa. You know, people are interested in interrogating assumptions about Byzantium's relationship to its Roman past, as well as its Western kind of contemporary sibling cultures, and how scholars like Nate, both in this work and in his own work, are, you know, thinking about its incredibly rich afterlives. And I think all of this just opens Byzantium up to such wider chronological and cultural horizons, you know, thinking about what counts as Byzantine, when what belongs in the field. And, you know, I think we're heading towards a moment where increasingly we're comfortable thinking about Byzantium not as a kind of closed off, embattled world, not as this fragment of antiquity in out of place in medieval time, or as this sort of storehouse of ancient learning that passes the torch to the West, you know, in these kind of traditional ways, but actually, you know, part of a constellation of different cultures and regions that are seen as being fellow participants in a kind of wider Byzantine civilization, which is centered on Constantinople, but isn't necessarily confined to the political borders of the Byzantine state itself.
Yeah, I think that's exceptionally well put, Jake. And I just, you know, as I think about this project and I think about the future of Byzantine studies, in some ways, I think that we can draw inspiration, once again, from Edward Gibbon. And, you know, one of the fascinating things about his later volumes is that while he's saying nasty things about Byzantium, he's also using the Byzantine Empire, the long history of the Roman Empire, as a kind of framework to tell a more global history. And I think that that's precisely the kind of work that that Jake is lionizing, and I agree with him completely. I think that that's the exciting future of Byzantine studies. I should say we're not the only people who are interested in this. Obviously, there are a lot of other scholars who are doing this, and I think that there's a kind of a blueprint in some ways from the way late antiquity has developed as a field, and there are some great, I think, really promising sort of overlaps in kind of methods and frameworks between the study of late antiquity and the study of the Byzantine world. And people who are explicitly trying to sort of bring those together to think about Byzantium not as a, you know, predominantly Greek-speaking, you know, imperial culture centered on Constantinople, but rather as a framework for seeing connections across space and time in Eurasia into and into Africa, as a cultural space that whose influence you know permeates the boundaries of the old Roman Empire and connects to, you know, states like Nubia and Ethiopia, you know, a range of linguistic cultures outside of Greek in the Near East and in Europe. So I think thinking about Byzantium, yes, as a kind of box for all of these fascinating, you know, connections is the exciting future that I anticipate and I want to be a part of. And for our own part here in this book, I think we're just trying to do one tiny piece of that. That's not so much it's not so much synchronic as in just looking at the Middle Ages, but it really takes that imperative and imagines it diachronically. That is, how does Byzantium give us a way to talk about scholarly cultural, political developments beyond the sort of chronological end of the Byzantine Empire into the world of early modern erudition.
All right. Thank you both so much for answering that. I'm personally excited to see what Byzantine scholars and students will be studying, or how they're going to be seeing the field in 50 years from now, for example. So that's definitely something I'm pretty excited to see. I've taken a lot of your time. I really appreciate you both. I would like to ask you one last question before you go. What are you up to nowadays? Any interesting new projects that you're working on?
Well, actually, so, go ahead, Dave.
No, you go, Jake.
so we, Nate and I are now kind of beginning a follow-up project to this on Byzantine antiquarianism, we call it. You know, part of what we think is left out of this volume is the engagement, particularly with material artifacts of the Byzantine past, the collection of Byzantine coins, the study of inscriptions, the study of buildings, both by Western travelers to what was then in the early modern period, the Ottoman Empire, as well as Ottomans themselves who are living amidst the kind of architectural and material remnants of the Byzantine past. How did they make sense of that? That's something that I wish we had been able to address in this volume, but we've reorganized back in October a colloquium on this topic. And so we're hoping that there's going to be something to come out of that further to build on this. In addition, I'm sort of working on my own project, which is totally unrelated, on the history of blinding and corporal punishment in Byzantium and the ways that that can tell us about the ideas, ideas about the body and disability, and how that factors into political legitimacy in the Byzantine world.
Yeah, so as Jake said, we're working on this project about material culture in the Byzantine world. We're also kind of maybe developing something about Byzantine studies in Vienna specifically, which turns out to be one of the really fascinating centers for a kind of emergent Byzantine scholarship, especially in the 16th century. And then, like Jake, I'm also working on a book that's coming out of my dissertation, which is provisionally titled Empire Beyond Rome. And it's an exploration of many of the themes that are discussed in this book, the competition over the legacy of the Roman Empire in the late medieval Mediterranean, and the way the arrival of the Ottomans as their own claimants of a kind of syncretic Roman imperialism really prompts Europeans to reconsider some of their older medieval antipathies and the way that they sort of reimagine the connections of Byzantium to older categories of empire and Christianity in Europe.
Amazing. Best of wishes for all of your projects. And I do look forward to the second project from both of you. I want to thank you again for being on the show today. I had a great time talking about Byzantium. Thank you so much again, and take care.
Well, thank you, Evan.
Yeah. Thanks.